91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we salute the centennial of the U.S. National Park Service, an agency in the Department of the Interior. The service was created in 1916 under the signature of President Wilson. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Since 1916, the number of national park facilities has reached 59. The oldest national park is Yellowstone. South Florida's Everglades National Park was dedicated in 1947. Biscayne National Park was formed in 1980 from the Biscayne National Monument. And Dry Tortugas went from monument to national park status in 1992. Both Dry Tortugas and Biscayne National Park are largely aquatic, but all are readily accessible to South Floridians. More in minutes after the news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you today.
Hope you had an enjoyable
fourth.
It
was good to see you one night this weekend, Bonnie.
Yes, it was indeed.
We had a good time. Well, today is devoted to our national parks. First, it's the 100th anniversary of the creation of the National Park Service. Second, we'll focus on our region's national parks, and we're blessed by close proximity to four such sites.
Everglades and Biscayne National Parks are at our back door, of course, but also Dry Tortugas National Park and the Big Cypress National Preserve are nearby.
With us now by phone is Jeremy Barnum. He's the Public Affairs Officer of the National Park Service in Washington, D.C., and he'll tell us about the history and scope of operation of the service. Welcome to you, Jeremy Barnum. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you. And in the studio, we have the Chief of Resource Education for Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Parks, and that would be Alan Scott. Welcome to you, Alan.
Good morning, everybody.
And also in the studio, we have William Cheek. He's the Chief of Interpretation at Biscayne National Park here in South Florida. Welcome to you, William Cheek. We're going to learn a lot today about the parks and about these
and
gentlemen.
And the resources in them.
Yeah.
So welcome to you all. Let's start with you, Jeremy Barnum. It's August 25th. Park Service turns 100 years old. So as we mentioned in the open, could you give us a little history and the mission of the Park Service and the responsibilities?
Sure. So, yeah, we turn 100 years old on August 25th. The National Park Service started with the Organic Act, which was signed by Woodrow Wilson in 1916, and it essentially created a system that was entrusted with America's most special natural and historical landscapes. And we were given the charge to not only protect those, but make sure that they were accessible and available to the American people. That's often been called America's best idea because for really the first time in world history, the most special, beautiful, interesting places of a country were set aside not for a few or for the rich or for the powerful, but for all citizens. And that's been a hallmark of what we've done over the last century is to make sure that every American has the opportunity to enjoy their natural and cultural heritage. And going forward, that's really something that we want to focus on is making sure that as America's storyteller, we're telling this story through place and making sure that every American can find a portion of their story and their experience in a national park.
Most people associate the Park Service, or the national parks anyway, probably with the forerunner of the movement, which would be Teddy Roosevelt. But of course, as you mentioned, right, Wilson actually signed the bill. But didn't Roosevelt really kind of get the ball rolling?
He did. So Teddy Roosevelt, through the Antiquities Act, set aside a lot of the public spaces that eventually became national parks. And he, of course, there's that, I don't know if you've ever seen that iconic photo of Teddy Roosevelt standing with John Muir over Yosemite Valley in what would later become Yosemite National Park. And many people think that's really where the idea of a national park system was conceived. And that's a legacy that we carry on today. Teddy Roosevelt and John Muir really are some of the founding fathers of the national park system.
What is the process of designation? How does one qualify to be added to the system, the National Park Service, of the National Park Service, like a monument or a space? Or
it's either through congressional authority, so Congress has the right to create a national park or a unit of the national park system through legislation. And that's accomplished through the property clause in Article 3 of the Constitution. But then the president, through the Antiquities Act, can also designate national monuments if they're, you know, if they're of historic or some other sort of prominence in the nation that rises to the criteria by which national monuments are designated. And we've now got 412 units in the national park system. So a lot of people, when they think of national parks, they think of the 59 kind of traditional national parks. But the National Park Service is entrusted with protecting national historic sites, national historic trails, things, you know, ranging from the Statue of Liberty to the birthplace of presidents. So it's a really broad mission, but it's really intended to kind of encompass both our natural and cultural historical heritage.
Now, there are national parks, national preserves, national forests. Let's say with the case of Big Cypress here in South Florida, it's a national preserve. How does that distinguish between, say, Everglades and Biscayne National Parks?
Right.
And the
Sometimes
Tortugas?
The way in which they're managed differs a little bit according to that designation. Also the way that they're created through the specific legislation or authority. But really the main difference is what the mission of that designation is. And, you know, it also governs what kind of recreation and use can take place in those areas.
How challenging is it? And we'll get to our guests that are in the studio and talk about our regional parks here, but Jeremy, how challenging is it to preserve resources at this time? I'm thinking climate change, natural disasters, development, attempts to move the urban development boundaries.
Sure, you just named a few. The list is long. Climate change is certainly one, and that's something that you see in South Florida, especially with, you know, dry tortugas as water levels rise. You know, the very existence of dry tortugas is affected. But we see that, of course, in other parks as well, be it Glacier National Park, where the glaciers could be gone in a few decades. It's very stark in some of our national parks in Alaska. But the challenges aren't just natural. It's also encroaching development.
Right.
It's use. We saw over 307 million visitors in the national park system last year, which is the biggest number of visitors to national parks ever. And while we want to encourage everyone to come out and find their park, those people have to have a place to eat, to get something to drink, to use facilities, etc. So just the sheer maintenance challenges of maintaining all the roads and facilities is a big part of what the National Park Service is addressing right now in our centennial year.
So there's a given that there's always a tension between, say, for wilderness preservation versus having the parks open to more people, and it's balancing on that line to satisfy everyone somewhat, I suppose.
Sure, and that's an inherent part of what the national park system is. National parks were created to protect and set aside these important places, but also to welcome and encourage every American to visit them. So it's been that way from the very beginning. And part of the reason it's important to us that we see so many visitors is we know that the national parks would not exist were it not for the support of the American voting public. And so without Americans getting out and visiting those parks, without national parks remaining relevant to a new generation of Americans, that threatens the very existence of the national park system. So while that's a challenging balance, we know it's at the core of what we do. And we don't shy away from taking on the challenge of welcoming as many people as possible to our national parks.
How do parks get their funding? Does it come from the government? Does it come from the state? Does it come from the region? Like, I'm thinking, if you have to preserve an edifice in a park, who gives that money
So first and foremost, it's congressional appropriations. You know, we're a federal agency. We get the vast majority of our funding from Congress, and that will never change. But the National Park System has a long history, really since the beginning of private philanthropy and working closely with private partners to not only set aside the areas that became part of the National Park System, but to also maintain and protect them. I mean, national parks like Grand Teton National Park would not exist were it not for the philanthropy of private individuals. So nowadays, almost every national park or unit of the National Park System has a local friends group that will include, you know, different partners from the community who are really dedicated to promoting the park, protecting the park, and helping, you know, find ways to address some of the needs that the park has. We also have an official charitable partner that I should mention, the National Park Foundation, that was created or chartered by Congress in 1967. And they are out there promoting the National Park Centennial, but also the protection of national parks and finding resources for national parks through the Find Your Park campaign. So if you go to findyourpark.com or encuentrotuparque.com, you can see some of what the National Park Foundation is doing as well.
We're speaking, we're listening right now to Jeremy Barnum. He is the Public Affairs Officer of the National Park Service. On today's Topic Occurrence, we're talking about the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. When we come back, we'll be joined by the Chief of Resource Education for Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Parks. That's Alan Scott, and William Cheek, Chief of Interpretation at Biscayne National Park, after this short break.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents on WLRN. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman with you. We resume our conversation with Jerry Barnum, Public Affairs Officer of the National Park Service. And also we'll be meeting the Resource Education Chief for Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Park, Alan Scott, and also William Cheek, the Chief of Interpretation at Biscayne National Park. Jeremy Barnum, before we open up our phones and also get to know the other guests, tell me about national parks and their number of visitors per year. For the most part, are they going up on a constant, steady basis? And what also influences the numbers? So, I suppose some economic trends would. Maybe people staying
Absolutely.
At home, yeah.
So the numbers are definitely on their way up. We have steadily increased our visitation numbers over the last few years. And as I mentioned previously, we hit a new milestone with 307 million visitors last year. And there's a number of kind of factors that play into that. Part of it, of course, is we've been out promoting the national park system as part of our centennial goal of really creating a new generation of park visitors, supporters, and advocates. Some of it's economic. Gas has been cheaper. It's a little bit easier to jump in your car and head to a national park site. Part of it, though, is also the national parks have been brought to the people in more urban areas. So a lot of the designations of late have been in more kind of big cities or within close proximity to big cities. So people have better access in their own backyard to a national park experience. Some of our most visited national parks are places like Golden Gate Recreation Area near San Francisco, where that's essentially where, you know, a lot of folks in San Francisco go to get outside and enjoy the beautiful landscape that surrounds that bay.
Well, let's bring in our other guest, Alan Scott. He's the Chief of Resource Education and Chief of Interpretation at Visitors Services for Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Parks. Welcome again.
Thank you.
Back. And Alan and William Cheek is the Chief of Interpretation, Biscayne National Park. So, Alan, I was taken with the language of the legislation establishing Everglades National Park in 1934. Does that language include what it needs to in the 21st century? Does it need to be adjusted for the 21st century?
So looking at the language for Everglades or all national parks.
Everglades.
For Everglades. So that language talks about the wildlife, the scenic values and the Native Americans that were here in South Florida at the time. So they are still very valuable, as valuable today as they were at the time, and perhaps even more valuable today than they were when the park was established in 1947.
And so you don't, so it could just stand the way it is. Nothing needs to be added now.
So as far as the legislation goes, I don't think anything needs to be added to protect the park. It's us as people protecting the parks and what we do about that and how we go about it.
Well, if you would just, and let me just right away go to William Cheek. What is a chief of interpretation, which you are at Biscayne National Park?
Correct. So the chief of interpretation, we're responsible for overseeing the education department as well as all of visitor services. And our job is to oversee a personnel who interpret not only the resources but also the history of the parks. And we do this in person when visitors come to the parks, as well as reaching out to visitors who cannot reach the parks.
I suppose the 4th of July is a day not really anticipated by a lot of the park personnel there, because you might have people decide they want to do fireworks or something, or a lot of alcohol abuse.
So in the South Florida National Parks, there is a not our primary season. You know, South Florida is a target for the winter season. And so it's pretty quiet on the trails in the parks. But South Florida is a great destination for boaters and recreational activity on the water. Mm-hmm. And 4th of July was a terrific weekend for that. We have world-class fishing and boating activities here in South Florida, and there was a lot of that going on this weekend.
Alan, give us a little history of Everglades National Park. So it was originally Royal Palm State Park, and that was established by a man named Ernest Coe.
Actually, Royal Palm State Park was established by the Florida Federations of Women's Club, who got together and they decided that there was a tree island there, an island in the Everglades that had tropical vegetation and orchids and air plants. And they were so amazed that these tropical plants were living in North America and you could get to them on land and not have to leave North America to see these. And the land had been owned by the Flagler Railroad, and they got the land donated to create what was at the time the first state park. There were other state parks, but as far as a park goes, called Royal Palm State Park, and that was 100 years ago in November of this year. So that was the nucleus of Everglades National Park. Other things happened after that and before that that brought a lot of attention to Everglades National Park and the Everglades region. And one of those was that at the turn of the previous century, in the late 1890s up through about 1906, there was a hunting of the birds, the wading birds here in South Florida.
Mm-hmm. Plumes.
Plumes. Mm-hmm. It was plume hunting specifically. So egrets and herons. And the time of year that those were hunted was when those birds were breeding and they had chicks in their nest, because that's when the plumes looked the best. Mm-hmm. And so whole colonies were being wiped out, and that brought a great deal of attention to the region. And we began to understand soon after that the connection between the colonies and the whole greater Everglades ecosystem. And that's one of the reasons that people like Ernest F. Coe proposed a very big national park here in South Florida and actually got legislation passed in 1938, but because of economy and wars and things like that, the park wasn't established until 1947.
And William Cheek, tell us about Biscayne National Park, a little history about that.
So Biscayne came to be a little over 50 years ago in the 1960s. There was talk of developing Biscayne as you would say Miami Beach. And the idea was to develop this part of Biscayne Bay into another Miami Beach. And also, the idea was to build a seaport by way of building a highway from, say, Miami Beach down to the Florida Keys. And a group of environmentalists came about in the 60s to form the Safe Progress Association, led by Lloyd Miller. And these guys fought to save the bay, essentially, and to do away with any building south of Miami Beach. So it was in 1968 when President Johnson signed legislation to establish Biscayne Monument, later in 1980 developed into Biscayne National Park.
And how rare is it for a park to be dominated by water rather than landscaping?
Very rare. Like 96% or something?
Yeah, 95% of the park is water, with just 5% on land. So it's very rare. We are the largest marine park in the park system. Very proud to hold that title. And, you know, that's part of the kind of hard part getting out to the park is that you have to get out on the water to really experience the park. So you almost have to have a boat to get out to the park. So that's kind of the difficult situation
right.
We're at Biscayne. But, you know, get over 500,000 visitors a year. Most of those are on the water. But we also, have a great program there on land there at the visitor center where we welcome visitors there as well.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, that's easy enough, 1-800-743-9576. Perhaps you'd like to tell us about your favorite parks nationwide and maybe areas where you'd recommend to other visitors. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, or email, that's radio@WLRN. We're visiting with Jeremy Barnum, the Public Affairs Officer of the National Park Service, also Alan Scott and William Cheek. William Cheek of Biscayne National Park and Alan Scott, Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Park.
How are, I guess in each case, in addition to all the other challenges that we talked about, the encroaching boundaries, the loss of habitat around the parks and all that, how do you deal with invasive species? In Biscayne National Park's case, at least it's the lionfish, and in Everglades, at least it's the python, among other. Alan?
There are lots of invasive
pine trees.
Species.
I know there are lots of invasive, but so in general, how do you deal with them then?
So the first line of defense is to prevent them from getting here in the first place, which is really, really hard. And there's a new invasive species that we're working on right now, which is called a tegu, which is a lizard, a very large lizard. It's not as large as an alligator.
But it compares?
But it can be 3.5 feet long. It's like one of the big iguanas you're seeing around. But they really like to eat bird eggs. And the Everglades was established for the native wildlife, which includes a lot of wading birds. We're trying to prevent them from getting established in the park. And the way we're doing that is we work with both federal and state agencies. And we hire people and we train them to set out traps. And we along the park boundary, and we're trapping them and removing them.
What do you do with them?
We find out what they've been eating, and then we euthanize them, unfortunately. Yeah. There's the problem with some of these exotics is there's so many of them around. There's nobody really wants them.
Where are they from, the tegus?
I actually don't recall that at the moment.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
In the case of lionfish, evidently they were eating the fish in the tanks, and so the pet stores just dumped them in the water. In the pythons, we know how they got there. I was just wondering.
So there's two other kinds that are that you wouldn't think about, plants. So there are trees like Melaleuca or the paper bark tree, which people are familiar with in this part of the world, and they really like to grow well in the wetlands. And they replace the river of grass with these trees. And so we have, we work with the state and other agencies, and we actually physically remove them. We have different methods of killing them, removing them, and then trying to keep them out of the park when and preventing them from reestablishing. There's another kind of exotic that you probably wouldn't think about, and that is we were talking about lionfish at the coral reef. But in places like the Anhinga Trail at Roa Palm, there's fresh water there, and there are exotic fish there, and one of them is very familiar, tilapia. Tilapia, oh, yeah. You can get at the local grocery store or at a restaurant.
Fun. Right.
And when you're walking around the boardwalk at the Anhinga Trail, you can look in the water and see tilapia. Tilapia, an African species that were brought here specifically for aquaculture, for fish farming, for sale as food, and they escaped. And now they, when they're in the natural habitat, they are plant eaters or vegetarians, so they clear out the vegetation and change the habitat.
Jeremy Barnum, are invasive species a problem in other national parks?
You bet. One of the challenges of managing such a diverse system that has 412, you know, units with something in every state and U.S. territory is the challenges are very diverse. Where our country has just about every ecosystem you can imagine, and so do our national parks. So one of the ways we try to address that is education, because in many cases this is human caused. Coyotes have made their way to the East Coast where they weren't always indigenous, and raccoons have gone the other way. And a lot of that is essentially following people and human settlement. So doing what we can to encourage visitors, but also really working closely with local partners. National park boundaries don't generally have high fences, so a lot of these species don't know where the boundary of a national park begins and where it ends. And so it's really important that we work with those local communities to try to address that. Some of this, too, is brought on by climate change, as the climate changes in these particular areas and ecosystems. And some of that can't be prevented, so part of it becomes mitigation. You know, the problem happens, and we do our best to try to address it from really doing undue damage to the ecosystem in the particular park unit.
And William, talk about how it's a little more difficult to control, I would think, because you're dealing with a body of water, really, your invasive species.
With the lionfish, yeah, it's been a real difficult issue to control. We have over, you know, hundreds of thousands of lionfish at this point. And they have no natural enemy, no predator to do away with them. So, as Jeremy said, education is key. And then also with our resource department there at the park, they hold several events throughout the year to bring the public into the park, as well as contractors, to go into the park and do away with the lionfish. So,
as we learned last week on Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining, they are delicious. So you invite people to go to go fishing and have at it.
And come grill right
and,
after.
make some lionfish ceviche.
Yes, well, and it's supposed to be good.
Yeah,
actually.
You guys mentioned lionfish tacos, so it's definitely on my to-do list.
So, Alan, where do things stand with the Everglades restoration?
So things are actually moving along very well in some ways. So if you've driven across the Tamiami Trail, Highway 41, between Miami and Naples, you've driven across a bridge.
Which was a dam.
It was a dam. And now there's a bridge, and we have authorization and support from the state, and the state has moved forward to contracting another bridge about 2.4 miles long along the Tamiami Trail, and that's scheduled to start later this year. And that's a pretty big centennial birthday present for Everglades National Park. What that will do, it will allow the water managers to put more water in the Everglades at the right time of year and the right volumes in the right place.
Okay.
And
so they're trying to mimic the natural flow
Mimic the natural flow and the timing and the distribution of the water. in the River of Grass within Everglades National Park.
Is fire still a factor in the Everglades?
Fire is definitely a big factor. Fire is part of the Everglades. It was shaped by fire. When you go out and you look at the landscape, what you're seeing was shaped, the mosaic was shaped by fire. Fire starts this time of year from lightning. And we last week we had several fires out in the middle of the park that didn't threaten anybody out in wilderness. And in that situation, they burned and they were part of nature. So we also had some fires earlier this year that got really big right when the thunderstorm started and burned some of the pinelands. But the pinelands are rare, a rare habitat in South Florida. They're not rare in Everglades National Park, but they now are rare in South Florida. And the pinelands are maintained by fire. Without fire, the native tropical trees, which grow so fast around here, would replace the pinelands. And it's the fire that maintains the habitat that allows the pines to grow and to be open. And an understory would be fairly open and grass-covered. And that's the primary habitat for animals like the Florida panther. In fact, I would say the pinelands habitat here in South Florida is the most diverse habitat in South Florida on land. There's over 900 species of plants and animals living in the pinelands. The only other more diverse habitat is in Biscayne National Park and in the coral reefs along the off the coast.
William, so because of the water, you know, the problem in the Everglades, and you get a lot of that water, and there has been a sort of a shortage of that, what's happening? What are they doing there? What are you doing there?
So the park recently passed a general management plan a couple of years back, and the idea here is to try to restore and later maintain a healthy ecosystem. So we passed this in part with both federal and state partners. A part of that was to establish a marine reserve zone where the idea is to leave it in this natural setting. So to not allow boating and other activities in this zone.
And that was met with some resistance, I recall.
Yeah, met with some resistance. However, we had several public forums. We had over, you know, thousands of comments from the public. And again, met with both state and federal on the issue and held several meetings to come up with a general management plan. And remember, this is 15 years in the making. And again, this was signed off 2014.
Right.
So, still a lot of work to do, still a lot of, testing and, still a lot of education, for the public. And we're pretty confident, that the end result of reserving, the ecosystem, will benefit the public to enjoy the reefs.
Our telephone number 1-800-743-9576. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question. Perhaps you'd like to tell us about your favorite areas of our national parks. 1-800-743-9576 or email. That's radio at WLRN.org. First caller, Boca Raton, Joel. Hi there.
Hi there. I bought a pass several years ago for $12, and it's good for seniors, and it's good for the entire whole life. I pay only $12 to enjoy a park every day. That's not right, I don't think. That's cheap.
So you're happy with that $12 pass? Good.
I am happy. I can go to Yellowstone, Glacier, any place.
Wow.
And I don't have to pay anything anymore.
Tell us more about those plans, Jeremy Barnum.
Well, there's a couple of different plans. One of the passes is the America the Beautiful Pass, where anyone for $80 can get an annual pass that will admit you to any national park that has a fee. Now, it's important to note that not all national parks or units in the national park system actually charge for entrance, and you still have to buy your own soda or hamburger while you're there. But also for senior citizens, there's a pass that is for life, I believe. If it's still $12, I'd have to double check, but that's essentially good for life and probably the best deal in the national park system. Also, maybe I could plug one of the programs that we have as part of our centennial this year called the Every Kid in a Park program, where the administration has made it possible for every fourth grader in the National Park System to get a free annual pass for both the fourth grader and their families to any national park in the country. And that's one of the ways that we're encouraging kids to get out there and find a park and learn something and have an interesting natural experience, but also to take their families with them.
Alan Scott has more on that.
Yes.
So we're inviting every fourth grader in the country to visit a national park or their public lands and bring their family and friends with them. And it's very easy to get a pass. Any fourth grader can go online and to everykidinthepark.gov, or to nps.gov. And the first thing you'll see is how to get your Every Kid in the Park pass. And they answer a few fun questions, print out a document, and take it to any of the parks, and then they get a pass that they get to hold on for a year. For a year.
That's a great thing. And what other events are going on at Biscayne National Park, you know, for the centennial?
So we have several events going on that have actually taken place beginning earlier this year and will continue throughout. One that we're particularly proud of, we're doing boat tours, and this is an agreement that we have with the county, Miami-Dade County, through use of their Pelican Skipper, and we're able to do boat tours out on the bay on the weekends, and this has been going on since February, and we'll continue in this these boat tours through the end of the year. We've also hosted Centennial Nights, which is part of a series of events where we invite the public to come to the park after hours. And we've shown videos. We've done night sky programs. We've also done evening cruises. So those are just a couple of events. We have citizenship ceremonies throughout the remainder of the year, as well as family fun days, which are events where the community, the local community, comes out. So really a focus on homestead, bring out family and friends. And this is the 16th year that we've expanded it, and it's really a great opportunity to come out and meet your park.
Okay, and we'll get to more events. That was William Cheek. He is with Biscayne National Park. We're also with Jeremy Barnum, Public Affairs Officer of the National Park Service. And Alan Scott is with Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Park. A short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents, National Park Edition. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon. We're speaking with Jeremy Barnum of the National Park Service in Washington, D.C. Also from Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Park, Alan Scott. And William Cheek is Chief of Interpretation at Biscayne National Park. Alan Scott, let's talk a little bit about Dry Tortugas, which I suppose even many people in South Florida haven't gotten to, because you can only go by boat or by seaplane. The history of it is just incredible. Tell us the story.
So, first of all, if you haven't been, I highly recommend it. It is about 70 miles west of Key West, out in the Gulf of Mexico. And you were talking about a small amount of land. So Dry Tortugas National Park is about 99 square miles of ocean. In fact, it's a beautiful, pristine marine environment, with less than 20 acres of land. And the largest island out there is Garden Key, and on the island is dominated by a fortress that was built a little over 150 years ago, part of the United States Coastal Defense System. The fort stands about 60 feet tall, three stories, and it's just massive, beautiful engineering feat out there.
How did they ever get all those bricks there? It's the largest brick structure in the United States.
They got them there by boat.
trip.
Yes, and there are also a lot of shipwrecks as a result of that. There are lots of supplies being brought to and from that area, but not just because of the fort being constructed there, but it was on the way to and from everywhere. So if you were going from the from New York and you wanted to go to up the Mississippi River or the other way around, you had to go around the southern tip of Florida. So it was commerce and shipping lanes. But it's not just the human use of the area. The birds are doing the same thing. They migrate through there north and south twice a year from South America to North America. Yeah. With the seasons, when the with the spring and the fall migrations.
So you can see that if you happen to go.
It's one of the best places you can go bird watching. So this little island dominated by
the information about the best times on the website.
Yes, you can look on nps.gov and type in dry tortugas, and you can figure out how to get there. The way to get there is if you have your own boat, you can go on your own, but I recommend you call us first. and there's a video online about how to get there.
What if you don't? It could be under attack? Or
It's a long way across the ocean.
Yes,
so you really need to be prepared.
Ah, okay.
So there, we have a concession that provides ferry service daily out of Key West. It's a two-hour and 15-minute trip each way that you get on the ferry at 7:30 in the morning, you get back at 5:30 in the afternoon. You spend about 4.5 hours out there on Fort Jefferson. You get to go snorkeling and explore the fort.
Just a thumbnail of the Civil War and, of course, assassination history.
So the fort was not built because of the Civil War, but it was definitely affected by the Civil War because the supplies needed to build the fort were coming out of the South, and the fort was a Union fort. Mm-hmm. So when you go to Dry Tortugas today and you see Fort Jefferson, you can see when the Civil War started in the sides of the fort, because from one point up, the bricks changed color. And that's when the Civil War started, and everything built
changed.
After that became a dark red brick as opposed to a yellow brown brick. So then also as a result of the Civil War, there were a lot of prisoners who were, and this was one of the worst places to ever be sent if you were a prisoner or if you were a soldier.
It was like
Papillon. For that matter.
It was almost like Papillon.
You have to remember there was no such thing as air conditioning at the time. And the name Dry Tortugas, there were a lot of turtles, but not much fresh water. So it was a harsh place to be and very warm. If you're out walking around in South Florida today, you know how really warm it can be. So they sent some of the Lincoln conspirators.
Right.
And William actually has a connection to this because he used to work at
Ford's Theater.
At Ford's Theater.
Oh. Yes.
And there's a direct connection between Ford's Theater and Dry Tortugas National Park. And that is that's where Lincoln was assassinated. The person who assassinated him, who shot him, broke his leg. And then there was a doctor named Mudd, Samuel Mudd. And he was convicted and sent to Dry Tortugas and imprisoned there.
And related to Roger Mudd, the newscaster.
There's a lot of Mudds, yes.
And isn't that where the expression, their name is Mudd, comes from?
I think so.
We have an emailer. Noonan wants to know, has a property not more than 4 miles from the Everglades Ernest Coe Visitor Center and had multiple sites of tegus, the invasive species, in my yard. I think I have a good-sized colony. Is there any available training offered by the parks to regular citizens on how to catch the invasive species? If there is, I would like to obtain information.
I'd be careful about that, too.
Will they attack?
The tegus. So tegus are here because they are interesting pets. And people brought them here as pets. And if they're raised by hand rather than in the wild, they act, you know, they'll crawl up on sit on your arm, sit on your lap, watch television with you, that kind of thing. So, but once they're in the wild, they're very ferocious. They have a lot of teeth, and they can hurt you. I would not try to pick one up.
So what should Nguyen do?
So There's a website you can go to. I found one. And you can report any exotic species that you find. There's an app you can also download to report exotic species, take a picture of it, and report it. And
I found one is the name of the website?
Yeah, I'm going to have to look that up.
Okay.
And send it back to you.
All right. Okay. All right. So we have some sort of living samples that Adam has brought us, Alan has brought us here. Joe?
Well, we have a skeleton that has very big teeth. Now, looking at this, I would think it has to be some kind of a cat. It's kind of small to be a saber tooth. What do you think it might be, Bonnie?
Well, the teeth are those, what are they called?
Canine?
Canine teeth are awfully large.
But it's not a canine.
But it's not a canine. I would say, what would you say?
I'm not sure, but maybe Alan Scott mentioned it prior to us.
You definitely won't find them in Biscayne.
No, you won't find, but you will find them in the Everglades.
You will find them in the Everglades and in Big Cypress National Preserve and in the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge.
And that's the answer.
And that's the answer.
Okay.
Yes. It's the largest cat that lives naturally in North and South America, the Florida Panther, also known as a mountain lion or puma or catamount. Those are all common names for the mountain lion.
Now, we have a small skull here also that has a lot of teeth and is pretty recognizable. Obviously, it's a gator. It's not a crocodile.
Right.
And that, oh, it opens.
So a crocodile has a much shorter snoot, right?
So
rounder?
It's a different shape.
Yeah.
So you can tell the difference between an alligator and a crocodile by looking at the shape of their nose, but if you're that close, you're probably too close.
Okay.
So but here's a good way to think about it. So the American crocodile, which lives in both Biscayne National Park, Biscayne Bay, and Everglades National Park, and in the Florida Keys, and at Dry Tortugas, they live in salt water. They're not like the Nile crocodile or the Australian crocodile that live in freshwaters. And they, in living in salt water, they feed on fish. And they have a long, narrow snout that are good for grabbing and holding on to fish. So their snout is kind of narrow and pointed looking. Whereas the alligator lives all throughout the southeast United States and eats anything.
Maybe they could eat the lionfish.
Yes, alligators and crocodiles both eat a lot of fish. They like to eat fish. But they're reptiles, and they don't eat a lot of any one thing.
Ah. Okay, we have to get to this, though, Joe.
Yeah, it looks like a huge boomerang.
It looks like a tusk from a massive elephant.
It weighs about 8 pounds or
7 or 8 pounds. And it was really hard to figure out what it was. So, I don't know that we did.
I think we... I think it was disguised as a manatee, one of the 18 ribs of a manatee.
It's enormous.
It is enormous.
And tell us why their ribs are so heavy.
Well, if any of you are divers, you know that when you dive and wear a little wetsuit, you also have to put on a weight belt. Well, manatees live in the water, and they don't want to fight against their own buoyancy, so they grow their weight belt in their bones. So their bones are super dense. And that offsets their buoyancy.
This is huge. This is like 4 feet, would you say?
No.
3 feet? 3 feet.
Yeah, like 30,
maybe.
Yeah, 32 inches or
something. Okay.
Well, this has been a very interesting hour.
We should get websites, though. We don't have time. Website, Alan?
So the easiest way to find any national park is to go to nps.gov.
Okay.
So that means nationalparkservice.gov. And then type in either the state you're in or the park you're interested in.
Okay, we want to thank you, Alan Scott, of Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Parks. It's been a pleasure having you. Also, William Cheek is with Biscayne National Park, and Jeremy Barnum joined us from Washington, Public Affairs Officer of the National Park Service. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you very much.
You.
And that wraps up today's edition. It was produced by Polly Landis with technical direction from Jason Zabka, and Richard Ives is lead producer. Tomorrow's program begins with a visit by the mayor of Miami-Dade's third largest city and home to its largest entertainment venue. That would be Miami Gardens. He's Oliver Gilbert, the mayor. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.